Hello and welcome to episode 76 of the Road CC podcast. George here, as usual, and we have a particularly interesting episode today. So, Dave sat down with George Gilbert and Christopher Schwinker. So, George is the founder of Indie Velo, and Christopher is kind of esports journalist who has written for Road CC a number of different times. And they discussed everything around Indie Velo, which is effectively a new kind of indoor cycling platform that tries to integrate the tactics and intricacies of cycling better than existing things. So, you know, Zwift, for instance, you know, it's effectively how long you can cycle for, and it doesn't really actually take into consideration the skills that it takes to cycle. So I think George put it in a particularly good way of when you go to the Olympics, it's not the guy with the biggest thighs who always wins. So I think that was a really interesting way of looking at things, and interesting to look at how it's kind of Indie Velo came about and the future of it as well. And Jack also sat down with Lauren O'Brien, who is a London-based cyclist who was a guest on Radio 4 for an episode called Should Cyclists Stay in Their Lane? Now, this is a bit of a kind of a long-standing thing with Road CC, which is that we cover quite a lot of these weird culture war programs that seem to come up a lot of the time on TV where they're trying to pit motorists versus cyclists, and you know, cyclists have done everything wrong. And so it was really interesting for Jack to discuss what it was actually like in terms of being on that program, because she did come up against somebody who has since had a fairly negative kind of reception on social media from some cyclists. So it was particularly interesting to hear exactly how that panned out from her perspective. And I think it's actually more balanced than it kind of comes across a lot of the time. But I think it was very interesting to hear exactly how she dealt with it. So I'm not going to keep you guys any longer. Here is episode 76 of the Road CC podcast. And here is Lauren speaking to Jack. Hi, Lauren.
Hi.
So we are, this episode is a bit of an unusual one because we're kind of debriefing a podcast that you appeared on the BBC. So a podcast about a podcast, if you will. but we just thought, as Road CC is obviously a cycling podcast, and BBC's anti-social covers a wide variety of issues. Just turned it on there. I was listening to some parts before this conversation. But the idea of the show is they'll get two people with varying, differing opinions on an issue. You'll get to say your piece, but it's done in a considered way with no shouting. Just to give a bit of background, I think the BBC clearly went out to get the idea, should cyclists stay in their lane was the topic. that was something that was disputed, you know, something that various people on social media weren't too impressed with. But then, as usual with these things, the episode itself was probably more insightful than the title would suggest. As we understand it, the BBC went out looking for a cyclist, which was you, eventually. After, in fact, Road CC was approached to be on the show, but for various reasons, it probably worked out better that it was individuals rather than a publication being represented on it. And then they also, obviously, the other side, they wanted someone who was a bit less friendly towards cyclists, and the idea was to have you do discuss various things, see if you could find common ground. And there was little facts and bits from academics interspersed in there. So
Can we just, I just wanted to ask how, well, basically, how was it for you? How do you think the show went? Did it give a fair representation of the issues it tried to present?
Yeah, I think, I mean, you could have done 2-3 other shows on the topic. I think it was very hard to fit everything into that show, but I hate listening to myself back with these kind of things, but I did listen back and I was quite happy with the questions and my answers, to be fair. And I think overall it was very, I think it was actually more pro cycling than pro car, actually, in the general terms. But there were so many things where it would have been really great to explore it a bit further. And there were times when James would say something and I'd really want to counter argue, but the conversation kind of just kept flowing in different avenues. So it was, there wasn't the chance to kind of go back and forth with a particular topic. So for example, like the highway code changes, it would have been great to explore that a bit more. Or right at the end, we started talking about the environment, like literally right at the end of the show. And it's like, I think Adam said something like, oh, we've not even had time to talk about the environment factor. And it's like, that's a show in itself. Like that's one of the main reasons people choose to cycle. Like that's a huge drive for people. So yeah, I think a shame we couldn't explore some things more specifically, but overall I think it was a good sort of overview, I think, of my opinions anyway, of cycling in the UK and where we're at.
Yeah. I mean, as I just personally perceived it, there were, it did appear a little stunted, but then I understand that the idea of the show is it doesn't turn into a slanging match. It's the BBC, right? So I think their job is very difficult in that they have to appear neutral on everything. So for example, on BBC Question Time, if someone, a panelist says something that's patently untrue, then the presenter's supposed to, say what, maybe give a counter to that. But the way that the show was, there were just a couple of examples I thought of things that could do with a little bit of qualifying information. So for example, you're Lauren O'Brien, the cyclist, and we have James Woodhausen, who the anti-cyclist. He wouldn't say that himself because he said that he was a cyclist, but then self-prescribed as a cyclist who is also pro-car, I think he said at the start.
Yeah, interesting.
I've picked out a couple of quotes here. So he said on the actual issue, the point of the issue, it says here, TV and radio presenter Jeremy Vine posts a video of a car failing to give way to him while he's riding a penny farthing. So this was like the fuel for the episode, that was a contentious issue. And now we're going to discuss it. In that clip, I think you see Mr. Vine on his penny farthing. A driver cuts across a cycle lane according to the highway code and the law, should have given way to him and the pedestrians trying to cross. And that was the original point of the episode. James Woodhausen says at one point, Jeremy Vine is being the vanguard of the government's war on the car. We don't face a war on cyclists, but we do face, in a whole variety of ways, a war on the motorist, who are regarded as so last century, the wrong side of history, testosterone-fueled men, and people have to stand against this war on the car. if you were going to answer him unedited and honestly, what would you have said?
Oh gosh, I mean, this illustrates a massive point with that show that we were talking about generalizations, and he at the start was saying, I won't make any generalizations, but he's just done that by saying people view motorists as these like men, petrol fueled men. And And I mean, that was such a huge point of that show I hope we kind of got across in some way that we can't be generalizing like that. And because at the same time, I mean, he says as a war on motorists, he clearly hasn't done a lot of cycling, because if you go out on the road, it feels like there's always a war on cyclists. Like, you always feel a little bit victimized when you're out on the roads riding by cars. I do, at least once on a ride, I will feel like something's happened, where it's, I don't know, it might be someone revving behind me, being impatient, or close passing me just to make a point. So it's all, yeah, it felt, for someone who didn't want to generalize, he was doing that a heck of a lot. Let's put it that way.
And perhaps that if you, like I said, the BBC have a very hard job. You can't expect Adam Fleming to be, you know, an expert on this issue. He's a presenter who's supposed to know, really has to know everything about everything in his position. At one minute, he's doing a podcast about transport cycling, and the next he's, you know, maybe talking about an election or a war. It's an incredibly difficult job, but maybe, yeah, that point about there being a war on the car, perhaps a good thing to mention would have been, well, actually, the Prime Minister himself said, we're on your side, addressing motorists 2 or 3 months ago, saying this rhetoric that we're going to stop the war on the car, whereas the guest in this episode was saying there's a war on the motorist being perpetuated by the government, when the government itself says that it doesn't. He also said, then he went on to local authorities conducting a war on the car through surveillance, through hatred of motorists, and again, another thing that isn't true, through road taxes that people want to apply. Through the road pricing that people want to apply. And again, there was no statement to say that, well, actually there is people in high places who will have touted these ideas like road pricing, but at the moment there actually isn't any evidence that that's a plan for the government.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's confusing war on motorists with making roads safer. Like, all those things that he's talking about, like speed limits, you know, more speed cameras, LTNs, like, he's taking that as a war on motorists, like a personal persecution. But actually, all those things are actually just trying to make people safer that use the roads. And I believe it was Nathan who brought the stats on that show as well. And it was a really interesting stat that in these areas where the speed limit is slower, 20 mile an hour speed limits, the fatalities are dropping massively. There might be a number of injuries, like that was still high, but the actual fatalities were so low as opposed to these like rural areas where those speed limits are, you know, a lot higher. So yeah, I think he might be confusing war with just trying to make the road safer. And like that lady, I'm sorry, I can't remember who the specialist was that they talked about for the highway code. She was brilliant, and she outlined all these things that people should know, but you know, all these things that she highlighted are just trying to make people safer, aren't they, at the end of the day?
Yeah. So did you feel like you got a fair hearing on the show? Apart from there were points where you wanted to dip in, but the overall impression you got was that it was pretty fair and balanced.
I feel like it was more on my side than his side. I definitely feel like I walked away feeling that I'd had my. I feel like if there was a winner, which there obviously isn't, I feel like the cycling side might have done well. But I mean, like you said, there was always a few things where I really wanted to sort of talk back. Like, he talked about how he lives in South London and it's really hilly, and you know, we can't persecute people who can't get about, like older people or people with children, people who want to, like, I think he refers to people wanted to carry 3 loads of shopping. And in that instance, I just wanted to say, well, wait a minute, people do that all the time. Like, there's electric bikes for starters that are becoming a heck of a lot more commercial. You know, there are people, you see it in London so much, parents taking their kids to school in the I call them like kid taxis. I know there's probably a specific name for them, but when they're sort of on the front having a jolly good time and their parents are cycling them along. So that's an example of one of the things I really wanted to kind of like counter and say, well, wait a minute, these people, yes, there are always going to be people who have to drive. And that was one of the points of the show, that cyclists aren't wanting cars to just leave the roads. Like, that's not what we want. We want people to make smart choices. And I feel like he wasn't quite seeing the other options that were there for people. And maybe that's an education thing. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, the way I perhaps, yeah, there wasn't really, if I just look completely neutrally at the things you were saying and the things the other guest was saying, like I said, that these quotes that I pulled up, there were things in there that were quite large generalizations, and things that didn't align with the facts presented by the BBC, by the experts. But then again, like I said, the BBC has a hard job when they source and guess. They not only have to report neutrally, but I think that the organisation also has, it kind of has to reflect the position of people in society. And maybe James Woodhouse reflected what, because I think a lot of the things are saying were perhaps, the things he was saying were perhaps popular things to say, or something that if you said in at a party or in a pub, that numerous people might nod along and agree. So perhaps it's just where we're at, that if you want someone on who's like, you know, he was going to make an argument against or like is not so keen on cycling as a mode of transport, then you're going to get these tropes. And at the moment, they need to be platformed. We're not in a place where those things can be dismissed as completely untrue. I think at the it was quite insightful at the end of the episode where Adam Fleming, what did he say? This was like the very end of the episode where he said, we haven't had a chance to talk about road tax, which could be a whole series of podcasts. whereas I think in really it should have ended that by saying, which actually doesn't exist. or yeah. At least maybe I'd like to think the point he was trying to make was, that could lead to a whole series of discussions about road tax actually is a myth, and ring fence taxation to pay for the roads isn't a thing. Maybe it could be a thing, or someone is suggesting it, but that could lead to a whole series of discussions about how the roads should be funded. But again, a reflection of where we're at in society, that so many people think that's a thing. So it's acceptable to say it, really.
Yeah, and I do wonder whether that format of having, because I was there to represent cyclists, commuters, etc., and that's quite a big task, and I wonder whether that's the right way to get the points across. Because I think what the show did really well was having those little sections where they had other people talking about the stats, the highway code, and I had a lot of people who listened to it saying, actually, that made it a really interesting show. So it wasn't just you two giving your opinions, like it was backed up by information and details, which was great. But is it just fueling a flame, having, you know, someone like James, who's very, you know, on the motorist side, and then me, who's obviously going to be backing up for cyclists. Like, is that just fueling a flame that's going to make people a bit more angry? Like, I don't know. I don't know. It'd be interesting to see what people think about that, because I don't know whether it does help or not. And hopefully it does help, but sometimes it feels like it just fuels an argument that already exists sometimes.
Yeah, I guess everyone's idea of a cyclist is different. And this is something we were talking about before we hit record, but that perhaps the conversation was sometimes a little bit centric to London or city, especially those quotes about from James Woodhouse and about being nearly run over by a cyclist in Lycra and the aggressiveness. Whereas I think where I live, city, like cycling in urban areas, is much less common. It is very... you know, when I go into my little town, it's very rare that you see someone cycling on one of the main roads. There's not many cycle lanes. A cyclist to somebody around here is probably someone riding a road bike on a country lane. Whereas in London, it's a very different thing. So the conversation might have been a bit more skewed towards that. Yeah, like if you'd have had someone on from around here to discuss cycling, they might have come at it from a completely different angle someone who doesn't like cyclists, that let's put the person on that side of the fence. We're like, oh, well, yeah, I don't like being held up by cyclists. They're always on, you know, out where I live. Whereas you have someone in from a city and they see a cyclist as maybe somebody who's delivering food and running a red light or something, which is like a bit of a common trope nowadays. So, yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to have someone on to represent all cyclists and someone on somebody to represent all whatever the other side was representing, all pedestrians or drivers. Because let's not forget the two, like, drivers and cyclists cross over a hell of a lot, really, probably more than they don't cross over.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the whole idea that, and that was a big thing that I think they wanted with the show, which sadly didn't quite work, is having that representative. I mean, I'm quite lucky that I'm up north all the time because I'm originally based up there, so I do have this experience that when I go, and it's exactly the same as you put it, like I'm originally from Wakefield, and when you see a cyclist, it's someone, like, it's a serious cyclist, it's someone on a road bike who's, you know, out, and it's probably a bit more serious than, like, here, seeing someone just doing their shopping. I'm not saying those kind of cyclists don't exist up north, but you do have a different, it's very, very different. And, you know, in Wakefield, gosh, I mean, the only proper cycle lane is right next to the dump, so there's glass in it, so no one ever rides in it anyway. So it's really interesting going home and seeing that difference. But yeah, it would, I think I'm lucky to have that perspective, but it would have been even better to have someone, yeah, like you say, who has a bit more experience of riding up there, a lot more than I do.
Yeah, again, a credit to the BBC, because they did try you know, their utmost to get that representation. I think I mentioned at the start of the conversation here that they did approach various people, and they approached Road CC too, to see if we could get a guest onto the show, which, again, I think in the end it was probably worked out for the best, because we'd have had an individual representing themselves and then a publication, which would have been a bit unusual, I think. So I'm glad we took the back seat in that respect, and you were on representing yourself, and all cyclists, as it happens. They were looking for a mix of genders, and then ID. I think that the producer did say that they wanted ideally someone from outside of London. So in the end, you live in London now, but you're from Wakefield.
So live in London now, but I'm really keen race cyclist, so every weekend I'm basically in a different part of the UK, if not racing near London, so that's quite interesting. Yeah, when I go and visit the different areas to race, I was in Cleveland for the nationals the other weekend, and yeah, it's always a bit of a shock when you go to different areas. Not that they did it anything badly, but I think London, everything feels like gets sucked into this bubble in London, especially when we talk about this. It feels like a lot of changes obviously might happen in London first. There's more cyclists, obviously, that's just a fact. So it feels like the conversation does drive that way, which is a shame, but I can also understand why it does that as well at the same time. So yeah, it's a tricky balance.
Yeah. And did you find, what areas did you find that you had some common ground with your, with the person you was debating?
I think even though James might have contradicted this with some of the things he said, I do genuinely believe that he wanted this generalization thing to go away. And even though he might have generalized himself, we did agree on that. And one of the things I said in the show was, I would, you know, if something happens on the road and something dangerous happens, that I can't help thinking, is that driver actually seeing me as a woman, a girlfriend, a daughter, or are they seeing me as a cyclist in Lycra? Are they taking the human aspect out? And I feel like, I mean, it'd be interesting to see what, you know, listeners think and the public think, but I definitely feel like that when something like that happens. I'm like, are you actually humanizing me, or I'm just a cyclist wearing a helmet? So we did agree on that for sure. And he wants the same for cars. I mean, I fall victim to that. I generalize car drivers a lot, you know, especially if they're in an SUV. You know, I know he probably didn't put it very nicely in the show, what his thoughts were on SUV drivers, but we definitely agreed on that, that I have very strong opinions about people who drive SUVs. And I mean, we definitely agreed on that as well. So, but I fall victim to, you know, if I see an SUV driver, I immediately generalize that they're, you know, I create an opinion of who they are, which I won't use strong words, but they were very similar to James's, but maybe just not as strong. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, which is actually quite fascinating. And again, I think an example of how that might be unique to London, because I think if you were to take someone who described themselves as pro-car from elsewhere in the country, it would be unlikely that they would dislike SUVs or the driver of SUVs. But if you're someone who lives in London who's a pedestrian regularly, then yeah, that might make you start to see things differently, that you're not so keen on people driving larger vehicles and associate that with a lack of care, concentration.
I think that there's probably a very different opinion of that, those kind of drivers in more, you know, up north as opposed to London, and we probably didn't get into that as well. That's probably something else that didn't, you know, happen, because, and that's one of the big differences between the two. You know, you see an SUV in London and you're immediately thinking, why on earth would you be driving an SUV in London? Like, why would you need that car? Like, there's, you know, you're not off to a, you know, there's no farm down the road that you need to get to, or you're not going off road, or, and, you know, most of the time there's only one person sat in them as well. And I mean, that's a huge thing, and I can totally understand why people get angry about this topic, because it's very unnecessary in London, but it's different up north. So yeah, there's definitely differences with that topic.
Yeah. So do you think, again, with the episode and the opinions that were given, do you think it's the opinions you have and the opinion the guest had, do you think they're even the most common of opinions, or do you maybe think that if sometimes you can go on social media too much, and us as a publication, we'll see these opinions being reeled off. Something like the low traffic neighbourhoods debate, and it's so inflamed. But when you, as somebody who lives in London, like you said, where a lot of, if there's going to be a drive for more cycle lanes, more active travel, it's probably the capital where you're going to see a lot of those things happening first. So, and down on the street, if you mention this in amongst friends, would those opinions be as inflamed, or is actually the average person is maybe more indifferent than yourself and the other guest on the show?
It's so hard to tell, isn't it? Because like you say, you listen to or you see it on social media, and you see this big opinion about LTNs or whatever it is, and you think that you start to gain this idea that, like, oh, people, everyone must hate them. Like, there's this war on LTNs, and it's because there's a very small few, you know, very minority of people who are going to these platforms and trying to spread their negative opinions about it, or positive opinions, both. But actually, when I speak to people about it, not on social media, or you look even just at the stats, the majority of people don't mind it, you know, but the majority of people think it's a good thing. And one of the things I think about LTNs is, you know, if the government are trying to make more of them, then they must work. Like, you know, they wouldn't be putting something out there if it wasn't working, or it was causing more hassle than it was worth. So I do always have that in the back of my head, but yeah, I try and avoid gaining an opinion from what you see on like Twitter or socials, because it's obviously a very small group of people who are trying to spread that, and actually the reality is very, very different.
Yeah, this must cut through, though. I mean, we've had some examples on the BBC itself of perhaps low traffic neighbourhoods in particular, where the subject wasn't given a fair airing. In 2021, we reported The broadcaster was accused of failing to be impartial and cite readily available data, perpetuating the idea that the schemes were being used as a revenue raiser, which was denied by council representatives. There was an episode of the Today programme where Nick Robertson said residents can't use their cars inside low traffic neighbourhoods. That isn't true. So this rhetoric must be cutting through even to, and like I said, the BBC is a vast organisation. It's impossible, like I said, for the BBC to be completely impartial and factual on absolutely everything. But yeah, maybe a couple of examples where those issues weren't really treated fairly because of the opinion of maybe a minority of people.
Yeah, and it's so, I mean, like, you could have done a whole show on it, and you know, the BBC might have even been shown after that to view it in a certain way, and people might have backlashed at that and been like, you know, you've demonstrated this unfairly. But I do think it just comes to this point that you're not going to please everyone with these kind of shows, and it does make me think that with the antisocial program, it did the best it could, I think, to hit as many different points. And I think that's the best you can do with those shows. And the BBC, obviously, like you say, has to remain so impartial and has to be very careful what it says. But even if they can remain impartial as, you know, as day, but someone will definitely still be like, you said this and et cetera. So it's so hard to please everyone with this kind of topic, especially when it's such a heated topic like this, that's for sure.
Absolutely. So in general, you came away fairly positive about the experience. So what do you think for the future? Would you like to see more of this in the media, or are people just sitting down having a chat? Do you think this helps, or like you said, is it perhaps when you do talk to people on the street, it's not as inflamed as even the debate you were having, and so perhaps it's sometimes it's wise to simmer down.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we're talking about it, I think that's a good thing. I think in the format it was, I think it was, you know, I think it did work with those additional little bits of information about the Highway Code and stats, like it works. What I don't particularly think is helping is how they title these shows. Yeah. So should cyclists get back in their lane? I know why they're doing it. They want to entice people to listen. It's provocative. It's getting people, you know, interested in it because, you know, it's a spicy title. But isn't that kind of just fueling the problem of what we're trying to stop? We're trying to stop this war of us versus them. And the titles, I think, but like I said, it's a media outlet. They want people to listen to it.
They want people to listen, right? They want as many people to listen to that episode as possible.
Exactly. So that we probably can't avoid that. That's just how it is, isn't it? It's just marketing. But you know, that format, in my opinion, I mean, people might disagree, but in my opinion, I do think that works. And if you can get do that a few different times with different kinds of people, like we've discussed, people outside London, in more rural areas, get their opinion. I think, like I said this on the show, like with what I do on Twitter and socials, if one person looks at it or listens to it and think, you know what, actually, I'm going to be a bit more open-minded about that, or etc., then it's worth it. You know, you might not impact thousands of people, but if what you do helps, you know, change the perspective or opens the mind of, you know, a few people, then in my opinion, it's worth it.
Yeah, and there was one point where I think Adam Fleming said to you, why wouldn't, if there's a cycle lane, why wouldn't you use it? Road CC has an entire lengthy feature on this with all the various reasons why. And yeah, the way you put it like that, somebody who, if they see cyclists not using cycle lanes and it absolutely infuriates them, and then they heard you list the various reasons why you might not be using one, and that might change their perception, which has to be a good thing.
Yeah, exactly that. Like, I mean, the amount of times I don't use one in London, and not that I legally have to, like, it feels like you're doing something naughty, but you're not, like, you don't have to use it, because I know that I've had punctures on there in the past or something, or I can see that there's a van parked in it, like 100 meters up, so I'm not going to ride in it. And, you know, then yeah, that will be worth it if someone hears that and thinks, oh, okay, that might be why this cyclist isn't riding in it. Okay, I might not put, you know, wind down my window and shout something at them, which happened to me yesterday. If that can happen, then it's definitely worth it, in my opinion. But I mean, the education of the highway code is something that I think has been put forth all wrong. No one knows the rules, you know, and when they were doing that section about the highway code, I was sat there laughing, because there was stuff that it's like, you can ride two abreast, you don't have to ride in a cycle lane, you can cycle in the middle of the road if you feel safer. All these things drivers think are wrong and cyclists shouldn't do, but they are actually law. It's frustrating how that's not been educated well enough or been put across properly by the government. It's frustrating.
So you think there should have been much more? I mean, we said this at the time and covered this. We had a couple of opinion pieces on this. Mark Hamilton, who writes for us, who's a lawyer, legal professional, who was very much of the opinion that, yeah, there should have been more public information campaigns around this. And yeah, like you said, it's very different, especially most people will take one driving test in their life, and there's a whole raft of changes to something like the highway code and confused, like that. I think the one, this isn't cycling, but people crossing the road, and now that it's always been advisable to give way to somebody crossing the road, but then that was actually added as a rule that you should give way to somebody if they're already, they've began to cross. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they didn't appear to be anything on like a TV advert or just summing up the new rules would have been helpful. But instead we just had these, well, we reported on it. there was some awareness at the time, but perhaps not nearly enough.
Yeah, it did make me think, you know, when they did the whole announcement about the emergency alarm on your phones going off on that Sunday at whatever it was, like 1 p.m. or something, you could not miss that information. Everybody knew about it. It was like, yep, I know about this alarm. It's going to go off at 1 p.m. on Sunday, whatever. If they really want people to know about something, they find ways of doing it. And I know, obviously, that was quite an important thing to get across to people, because your phone was about to, you know, go off, and someone, if they didn't know, would have been like, oh my gosh, something's happened. But it's just a classic example of, if they want to relay information properly, effectively, they can. And with this, they just chose not to.
Right.
Controversial.
Yeah. Okay. Lauren, thank you very much for joining us. And
no worries.
We can find you on, listeners can find you on social media. And I'd imagine you won't be, there wasn't much from your guest that made you think that you'll alter your, your opinions on cycling too much.
No, I wasn't enlightened by this motorist standpoint after that show. I can't say that happened. No, I'm gonna, yeah, still very firm on my beliefs, that's for sure.
Overall a positive experience.
Yeah, I would definitely do it again. It was from my point of view, it was great, and I said everything I wanted to say, and yeah, I'd definitely do it again, put it that way.
Okay, thanks for joining us.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Hi guys, George here. So I wanted to do a quick shout out for an article that we currently have on the site called "The Problem with Bike Industry Launches and How to Fix It." Now, this is a really good article from Tony, who is one of the founders of RoadCC, about why we no longer send people out to these big international bike launches that I'm sure many of you have seen kind of posted all over social media. Now, predominantly this kind of comes down to a number of different factors, but it's mainly down to the fact that we are a cycling brand. We are meant to be environmentally friendly, and yet we are being sent out to these big launches in foreign countries where there's quite often dozens of journalists who fly in from all over the world and creating significant amounts of carbon in order to promote what is fundamentally an incredibly low, well, what is meant to be anyway, a low carbon product. But the article goes beyond just why we've decided to, not even just decide to make the decision, why we've decided to publicly say why we don't do this. But Tony also goes on to kind of give some recommendations about what should be done in its stead. Because fundamentally, it doesn't matter if RoadCC doesn't go, if there are dozens of other publications that still send all of their journalists out to these big bike launches. You know, it would be much easier and cheaper and more sustainable for these companies to approach it in a different way. So if you have a spare couple of minutes and you want to have a read, I would thoroughly recommend it. And it is my pick of the week in terms of RoadCC content. That's not the podcast, obviously.
Okay, well, here we are in the UK and we're moving into a time where you stop thinking about riding indoors and you start thinking about maybe it'll get nice outside. Hasn't happened yet, but it might, and we're all hopeful. But if you told me when we started RoadCC 15 years ago that riding inside would be a major part of my life, then, I wouldn't have believed you. At that time, we were on dumb trainers. We were looking at a TV with the Tour de France on if we were lucky, or if we weren't lucky, we were just staring at a wall for 45 minutes until we gave up in frustration and a pool of sweat. But, you know, the environment for indoor training has come a long way. Multiplayer environments are getting better and better. And today, I'm joined by George Gilbert, who is the founder of IndieVelo, and also by esteemed esports journalist, Mr. Christopher Schwenker, also a sometime contributor to RoadCC. So thanks for joining me, guys, on this nice day, actually, in Bath today.
No, thank you. It's lovely to be here with you.
And
always happy to discuss esports with you esteemed gentlemen.
Excellent. So, I mean, let's dive into where we're at the moment. So, George, you have you've developed a new platform, really, over the last how many years?
Yeah, it's been a couple of years now. It's been released for 1 year nearly, coming up to that, 9-10 months. It's been an amazing journey.
I expect it has. So for anyone that hasn't heard of IndieVelo, IndieVelo is another multiplayer online training environment where you can go online, you can race, you can train, you can just ride around and enjoy the view. If you're going to compare it to anything, probably you're going to compare it to Zwift because it's a similar kind of experience. But, I mean, why don't we talk about where you've come from, George, and how you've come to develop a whole new piece of software for us to go and hurt ourselves on.
Yes, definitely plenty of fun. Type 2 fun. the best kind. IndieVelo was born from ultimately a single thought of imagine if online cycling were an Olympic sport. And I really mean that literally. What would it actually be like? You know, what would the stadium look like? What would the athletes be doing? What would they be thinking? What would the races be like? IndieVelo is all about transforming cycling together, defining and building the new tech required for that Olympic dream. And it's important to emphasize it. You know, I don't presume to know all the answers, but there is an amazing number of people out there who have fantastic ideas. So I reached out to hundreds, thousands of people, and ask them, you know, riders, team managers, coaches, national federations, the UCI, and just ask them, you know, what would an Olympic Games actually look like? And what came back was a really consistent message around two points, tactics and credibility. So by tactics, I mean, win or lose, that your results should be based on your skills as a rider, not just your power. You know, if you want to go to the Olympics and see who's got the biggest legs, then take a tape measure, or you know, or go watch the weightlifting. But cycling is about skill as well as strength, and every decision that you make, whether it's your position in the draft, the speed you take a corner at, when the wind's blowing, whether to sit in or attack, or you know, where to make those kind of micro judgments that you make all the time in real life, if it's going to be an Olympic sport, then we should be doing that indoors as well. And from the credibility point of view, it needs to be that what you see and experience is that legitimate, proven athletic ability. It has to be believable, bluntly. You know, it's about accuracy and precision. You know, the platform needs to be commissarable, if that's a word. And that means kind of having this kind of fully built-in, real-time performance verification, everything from the ground up. So I'd kind of done all this research, and then I looked at the existing legacy first generation of platforms, you know, your Zwifts and Whooshes of this world. And they were all built and designed for training, for health and fitness. And that's important. We should never, ever forget just how utterly incredible and game-changing that health and fitness side of it is. But it's not racing. And the computer software architecture that's required for credible racing and tactically interesting racing can't be just bolted on. You know, it's like physical architecture. You can't take a two-story house and then just bolt on another 50 floors and call it a skyscraper. You know, it would just collapse under its own weight. And software engineering is very similar, actually. You've got to get the basic foundations right for kind of tactically interesting, credible racing. It's got to be part of the DNA of the platform.
Okay, that's a really interesting and quite a different place to come from, like you say, than the other platforms have come from in the past. So, Chris, you as an esports journalist with your own dedicated esports website, how do you feel at the moment that IndieVelo is sitting in the kind of diaspora of different platforms available? I know you've written a lot of kind of how-to guides on your site to tell people how to get into it. So how do you see it fitting into all this?
Well, I don't only write about IndieVelo, I'm also a user of IndieVelo, and I'm a big fan of everything that George is doing there. He comes from a very unique place with his skill set, right? He was the director of esports, the chairman of esports at Zwift for a very long time. He's a UCI commissaire. He had a position with British Cycling. So not only is he, you know, on the cutting edge as far as esports goes, but he also has that governance side, that the being able to look at the sport from many different directions. And in addition to that, he's, you know, an astrophysicist. You know, we forgot to mention that also. So he's able to really understand the physics for a platform. And as far as I'm concerned, and I've used all the platforms, the physics in IndieVelo is as close to real life as I've experienced. And that allows for a really dynamic and compelling racing platform. In addition to the fact that every single thing that you see on IndieVelo is purpose-built for racing, right? From the ground up, it's the DNA of IndieVelo is racing. And then there are other things that, you know, that appeal to other users, the wider user, but the platform is built for racing. And, you know, I'm sure George would agree that that's not sacrificed, right? That we do that, you know, first and foremost. And all the other things kind of fall into place. So, you know, George also alluded to the fact that there's a very passionate population of indoor specialists, I would say, that are, you know, really vested in creating a platform that is going to be as right as it possibly can for racing. That's going to be able to create a credible scenario where you don't have to worry about fairness. And, you know, let's face it, there's a culture of cheating in cycling esports. You know, that's a position that we're in. Like, I'm sure if you went to your local cafe ride and you asked some, you know, asked up your, you know, the guy that's riding next to you, you know, what do you think of, you know, esports, what do you think of racing online? His first answer would probably be, it's all just a bunch of cheaters. And that's, you know, that's the, what we're trying to get away from, because that's not the way to develop a sport. And my feeling is that we're, IndieVelo is the kind of trying to reach that ideal, and it's the closest that we have at this point.
Yeah, that's great. And I mean, obviously you've used the platform a lot. I've used the platform a bit. I've started in the last kind of few weeks to have a go and, you know, to kick the tires, as it were. And it has been a really interesting experience in that, I mean, I've used, over the years, I've used all of the different online platforms. And I think you're right, Chris, in saying that in terms of the actual kind of the way that it feels when you're riding with other people in a race is much more, it's much more like riding outside. So kind of easier to kind of dart off the front. And if you actually get off the front, maybe you can stay off the front for a bit. And that's always been an issue with Zwift when I've been racing, is that the pack dynamics of the big pack is such that really you never really get away in a flat race when, you know, in real life, people can dart off front and do all the time. And the kind of the way that you move within a bunch of riders is interesting, and it's different and feels more like the way that pack dynamics work on the road. So it has been interesting for me to try that and compare that. I mean, in terms of the racing, how do you feel like, where do you feel like you are at the moment, George, in terms of the kind of uptake and the types of racing that's happening and the whole kind of environment for racing? If it's a platform built for racing, how happy are you at the moment with where you're at?
Yeah, it's in a really good place, actually. We're rapidly approaching 20,000 users. We've held several multi-day stage races now, plenty of single one-off events with well over 100 riders in them. But it's really important that the focus here has been really on the technology rather than user acquisition. Terrible phrase. But we've got a sufficiently large number of people now that we can really test out the tech and provide a great experience for the riders who are helping shape that vision. And bearing in mind that we're still in beta, we haven't spent any money at all on advertising, marketing, PR, anything like that. 100% of those 20,000 users have just come from word of mouth recommendation between riders. And as soon as people try it, as you say, they love it. It feels like riding a bike, and they keep coming back. And it shows what you can do if you focus on crafting a quality product and prioritize the needs and views of the riders as your number one consideration.
Yeah. And, you know, the racing that I've done, it's interesting at the moment, because I've only done two races and I've won them both, because at the moment I don't think the system's just learning what kind of a rider I am, and I need to kind of get further into it before I start getting put in the pens where people are going to beat me easily, and then I'll probably like find my level like I do. But it doesn't have the same kind of category system at the moment, or isn't maybe designed to have the same category system as you find out on the road or you'd find in Zwift, where you have a specific, you know, you're a first cat or you're an A racer. There doesn't seem to be that kind of delineation. It's much more kind of organic.
So, and that's entirely deliberate. So what IndieVelo is doing beneath the covers is it's looking at how you ride. As you said yourself, it's learning about you and how good you are, and it's learning about how good you are in different scenarios as well. So it learns about how good you are on the flat, how good you are on hills, how good you are in short races, how good you are in long races, and when you enter an event, you just enter an event. You don't pick your own category, which means it automatically eliminates sandbagging because you can't pick your own category. But it's like if, you know, it's from any other gaming part of the world, and you know, if you're playing Call of Duty or Fortnite or whatever, you don't get to pick who you race against, who you compete against. You just get put in a group of people of your skill. And what IndieVelo is doing is it's exactly that same principle and process as all other multiplayer games in the world use. It looks at how good you are. It looks at who you've beaten. You know, if you consistently win, then next time you'll race against harder people. If you consistently lose, you'll race against easier people. And just by constantly iterating in the way that, as I say, every other multiplayer game in the world does, then it means that you're guaranteed to get a good, healthy race against people who are about your ability, no matter how good or bad you are.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really not looking forward to the day when it realizes that I'm not all that, to be honest. So, but that day will come. And Chris, from your racing experience, what are the things that you really like about this platform? Because you are, you know, reasonably evangelical about the way it works. So, what is it that do you think are the USPs for IndieVelo?
Well, there are several. First of all, the results-based categorization, the dynamic categorization that you just mentioned, is, you know, it's key to the credibility and also the compelling racing. You're always racing against people that are of like ability, and you don't have any reason to cruise a sandbag because that categorization is a moving target, and you never know what it's going to be, right? In addition to that, you are able to move up in rank. So, you know, you can see where you compare to other racers on the platform and to yourself. And if, you know, it's a game of skill, you want to be the highest rank that you can possibly be. So it really melds the video game into the cycling esports, which is kind of, you know, which is what we're really looking for. Right. And there's a team-based aspect. The other thing that's sort of unique about IndieVelo is that if there aren't enough racers in your category, it's populated by bots. And George has, you know, manipulated these bots using AI so that they race like humans, but they race like humans that don't have a conscience. They're attacking, you know, they're, you know, it's like, I've never once had a race on IndieVelo that went down to a galloping group sprint. It's always been moves that had to cover. There are bots that get away. There are bots that are covering. There are real people that are involved in this. And eventually, I know that the hope is that it'll all be humans and they'll all be racing this exact same way. And they'll have the opportunity to do that because of the physics and the other things that are built into the platform. Now, the other thing is that the actual vision to have this be something that, you know, could potentially be the platform for the Olympics, or, you know, the UCI has visions of perhaps having an international calendar, which would be multi-platform, and having an international ranking system, and having that in place, and, you know, IndieVelo being one of the venues for that to happen, and, you know, being prepared for that is a really powerful prospect to have.
Yeah, so what is the roadmap for the future, George? I mean, at the moment we're in a position where, you know, you've got a beta version that's working really well. You know, everything's working. You've got good take up in terms of users. You're still having to fill some of the spaces with bots, but I mean, we've seen that progress happen with other platforms, Zwift being, you know, the obvious example. When we first started riding around in 2014, it was full of translucent blue people, and now you don't see so many of those guys anymore. I mean, I think personally, it's really interesting that you don't really notice the bots in IndieVelo because it's difficult to tell who's actually human. in the way that people, in the way that the race, a race will evolve and people will attack and stay back. And like you said, Chris, it's really interesting to see that dynamic. And, you know, hopefully when everyone's human and everyone's a human racing, it will still have that kind of dynamic. But where are we now in terms of moving forward, George, to something that you're going to kind of push out there, tell people about? I know you already have kind of like a founder subscription thing that's going. And, you know, at the moment, people can use the platform for free, but obviously that won't be, that's not something you can sustain forever. So what's your roadmap for bringing it into kind of more of the public domain?
I think in terms of the roadmap, the honest answer is it's what the community wants. You know, I want to listen and hear the feedback. I want to understand what new technology and features the riders, coaches, team managers are interested in, and what they want. And yeah, prep pricing is going to be part of it, but there isn't a definitive secret plan for this or anything like that yet. It's really a question of getting the tech right. That's the most fundamental important thing. It's the whole castles built on sand analogy. And as I said before, it's about making sure that the foundations are absolutely rock solid before we move on and do the fancier, more public facing stuff. But it's a really exciting time in the evolution of the sport. And honestly, I'm delighted to play a part in that and help define the future of virtual sport.
Great. And I mean, obviously we've had 3 years now of Zwift being the platform for cycling esports, and now we're moving into a time when it's going to be MyWoosh that's doing it for 3 years. So in 3 years' time, are you going to be throwing your hat in the ring for that gig?
It's interesting how the dynamic plays. I've always seen IndieVelo as being more of a service provider than a competitor. You know, these other companies are billion-dollar companies who are throwing around enormous quantities of cash, and a small group of people with a real community-based focus can't compete against billions of dollars. So whether it's world championships or Olympics that is hosted on IndieVelo, well, that's I don't know about whether that's a credible future. But will the technology that we invent and we develop and craft on IndieVelo be used in the Olympics and World Championships? Yeah, absolutely.
And that was it, episode 76 of the Road CC podcast. So thank you, Christopher, George and Lauren, for giving us your time. I think it was really, I mean, let's be honest, it's a pretty broad subject area that we covered in this podcast. I think what George is doing at IndieVelo is really interesting. Zwift has become so ubiquitous with indoor cycling that I think it's good to see someone who's kind of challenging them, not necessarily to say that Zwift are doing anything wrong, but I think healthy competition is always pretty good. And then also just to hear Lauren's perspective on not just what it was like kind of being in the BBC studio in that kind of environment, but also just to hear her perspective on cycling in general, especially as somebody who's a London cyclist, which, you know, let's be completely honest, a lot of the coverage that we tend to get is very London-centric because that's our capital city and that's where a lot of the cycling investment comes from. It's where a lot of the culture wars happen. So I hope that you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. As always, if you want to get in touch, you can send us an email to podcast@road.cc, or you can find us on social media at road.cc. Just search it wherever you are. So until next time, cycle safe. Bye.